For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics with ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel and Republican political consultant Neva Hill. Well, a breaking story from NPR and ProPublica this week on Oklahoma's workers' comp law featuring the opt-out provision allowing companies to provide their own coverage and usually giving workers less money in the event of injuries and even death. Ryan, your thoughts on this piece?
This is entirely predictable. It's despicable, but it's predictable. We've watched for years, almost a century now, since Oklahoma and many other states, but Oklahoma one of the first, to create a grand bargain that allowed injured workers to get paid for and compensated for their injuries so that they could get better and back to the workforce if possible, or to compensate their family appropriately in the event that they're killed on the job, and then among business owners so that they can have some predictability in the liability that they incur in the event that one of their employees gets hurt. Since that grand bargain occurred nearly a century ago, we have watched insurance companies and corporations and their lobbyists do everything they can to tilt the favor in front in favor of profits instead of people. And during my time in the legislature, there were any number of workers' comp reforms that were rolled out. Now we have this opt-out provision. And what every one of these has done is they've tilted the playing field in favor of businesses, but in particular in favor of the insurance companies. And so now the average Oklahoma worker has fewer rights when they're injured on the job, and their families have fewer rights when that worker is killed on the job as a result of this. Frankly, I think that the idea that we are a better state because we're able to shave a few pennies off of a liability policy or off of a workers' comp policy, and we're treating workers like they're cogs in a machine, pre-industrial revolution standards. I mean, this is just unacceptable.
Neva.
Well, I mean, let's kind of back up and look at, first of all, the investigation. I mean, one of the things that I thought was interesting is when they talked about these nearly 1.5 million workers in Oklahoma and Texas, I'm wondering really what we're talking about in terms of how that breaks out for Oklahoma. When we really start to look at some of the data, I mean, we don't really, I think, know a lot. I mean, all of this back and forth on opt-out, which was one of the big arguments and criticisms during the whole fight for the workers' comp reform. Really, when you look at opt-out as a practice, I mean, you have companies that basically have to put up a significant amount of capital. They cannot leverage that capital. That capital has to be available to pay those claims. Once claims are paid, they have to replenish that money so that it stays at the 100%. I mean, it's a much, there's many more pieces to this equation than I think oftentimes it's simplified to. I think the other point is workers' comp, at one time, there was, I think, in my mind, it was indisputable that we had one of the most expensive, inefficient workers' comp systems in the country. We were one of the last states that moved the direction in terms of giving the employee the opportunity not to have to hire an attorney and go to the courtroom to get some resolution in the case of an injury or death, but rather have an opportunity to go to an agency and actually be able to represent themselves or bring an attorney if they wish. So it really opened up the process, and I think a lot of these stories that we hear are the isolated instances and not the across-the-board swipe at workers' comp as being this terrible thing that, frankly, from a business standpoint, from a state standpoint, has opened up and really provided a lot more economic growth and opportunity than it would have if we had not had the reforms.
A couple of weeks ago, the Oklahoman had a story that the businesses were saving a lot of money from the new workers' compensation system. But then the same week, the Tulsa World had one that showed that Oklahoma workers are some of the worst treated when it comes to workers' compensation. So is it worth the money that's being saved if we're considered one of the worst places to work?
Well,
and
again, I think it's whichever spin you want to put on those numbers, because when you look at the overall picture, you have to, first of all, I think, look at are we in a place where we're actually going to be able to maintain those jobs? I mean, it's not about, I think, most companies and businesses in Oklahoma wanting to do wrong by their employees. I don't believe that. I think yes, in every instance, we have isolated cases of people that have bad practices, don't do the right thing. But I think those are the ones that need to be targeted, focused on, and addressed, rather than taking this broad brush approach, which seems to be the way that the opponents of workers' comp reform have continued to try to discuss this.
One of the real takeaways for me in this story, Michael, is that There doesn't seem to be anybody out there looking out for these workers other than a handful of attorneys that are still trying to continue to afford to be able to represent these clients before the courts. The Oklahoma Insurance Department is, they're correcting grammatical errors in these insurance policies that are being submitted by these opt-out companies, but they're not correcting anything where they're deviating from actual state law. And I mean, you've got the legislature that has almost entirely been absconded to the insurance industry and the state chamber on this issue. They have just rolled over and given them everything that they want. And these workers are giving up things like being able to go to the doctor without having to have their employer send a designated representative to attend a doctor's appointment with them. I mean, this is just crazy.
Well, let's look at the other side of the coin. We had instances more than once when you had people come to the Judiciary Committee and other committees when this was being debated in the legislature, and they would say things like, yes, I got X number of dollars, let's say $50,000 for the loss of a limb or whatever it happened to be. But my attorney bill was more than that. So really, I came out through this whole process. The attorneys, if you want to talk about where the whole crux of the, I think the debate on this is being able to open up the process where the employee has more options than just being really in a place where the attorneys are dictating the entire political landscape as much or more so than the insurance companies.
The work comp fight is a proxy for two things. One, to increase profits for the insurance industry, and two, to undermine the political viability of workers' compensation attorneys who primarily donate to Democratic campaigns and candidates. And they've accomplished both of those things. They've increased profits. They've undermined the workers' comp political viability in the state of Oklahoma. And the only people that have suffered for it are the workers.
Hours after recording last week's This Week in Oklahoma Politics, Governor Fallon puts an indefinite hold on executions. Meanwhile, the Attorney General is asking for more secrecy in court over the lethal drugs, and the Tulsa World gets more than 40,000 emails from the governor on the handling of the original botched execution of Clayton Lockett. Neva, this has been a busy week.
It has, and you know, one of the things that struck me is this whole discussion of the Attorney General now saying that they want to investigate this, when the Attorney General was the attorney representing this particular agency, the Department of Corrections in question, which could be true of any of the agencies that they represent. So there's so many different things going on here, but if I were head of an agency and were relying upon my attorney to represent and be know all of the information and be in a good place in terms of in that role, and then turn around and say, okay, now all bets are off, we're going to stop and investigate this. We do have a lot of problems. We need to get to the bottom of it. Whether this is the best direction to go, I think is questionable at this point. It certainly is continuing to just, I think, make most people, including if you look at it, the legislators, you don't see very many people rallying trying to get ahead of this or have a lot of gamesmanship. Everybody seems to have stepped back and waiting for the dust to settle, and that needs to happen. We have a situation where when you have 112% capacity in our prisons, when we have 56,000 in the system right now, I mean, there are a whole lot of other pressures, and we're not even talking about the dollars and the budget implications. Then to be absolutely mired down in this, they need to get on top of it and do it quickly.
Ryan.
This is an albatross around their neck. You're absolutely right, Neva. The real issues and corrections ought not to be concerned with these absurd questions of how we're going to execute people in the state of Oklahoma. The stories that have broke over the last week take a lot of unpacking. You know, first of all, you know, these emails, you know, that have come out from the governor's office and elsewhere as a result of the botched execution of Clayton Lockett, it took 18 months for the governor's office to respond to this. You know, here it is, the state carrying out its ultimate authority to put somebody on a gurney, put a needle on their arm, and pump them full of poison until they're dead. And it takes us 18 months to get critical documents to understand what our government's doing in our name. That's just simply unacceptable. The other side of this is when we begin to look at these documents, we also see that inside the governor's office, and I'm sure that there are serious conversations, or at least I hope there are, about what it means for the state to take a person's life, but we're also seeing this PR crisis unfold, you know, and they're treating this like a PR issue, and it's anything but. And then now we have the Attorney General back in front of a court saying that we need more secrecy. Well, the secrecy and the lack of transparency, the lack of independent oversight, and our political insistence upon continuing the system of capital punishment in the state of Oklahoma has put us in this point that we're in today. So to double down on secrecy right now seems to me the absolute wrong move. Kudos to the governor for the indefinite stay. I hope that we continue to see that going forward. For me, it's hard to imagine how the state has any foundation to stand up and say that we're competent to execute somebody in the near future.
Meanwhile, the Oklahoma Public Media Exchange's Matt Trotter yesterday had a story about how the governor says there's not going to be any firings at the Department of Corrections because of this. Are you surprised that in a situation like this, heads aren't rolling?
Well, I mean, first of all, let's remember, it was the director of the Department of Corrections that really put the skids on the execution itself. Once there was an understanding that there was a question, it was the director who said stop. Let's make the calls. Let's see where we go from here. So I think that much of this again falls back to where are the lines, and if the Attorney General is going to be one day representing these folks, giving advice, giving direction, and then the next day saying, I'm going to investigate the very process, the very people that I was representing the day before, that seems very convoluted to me. I'm not the attorney in the room here, but that would seem to be a big question that I think needs to get answered.
Monday, the Tulsa World had an article on how political groups like the Oklahoma Council of Public Affairs are already using relocation of the Ten Commandments to raise money and plan to use it as a political issue in future elections. Ryan, are you surprised by this?
Absolutely not. The entire placement of the Ten Commandments monument to begin with was a political issue. What our plaintiffs in this case at the ACLU, our plaintiffs, largely objected to was the use of their deeply held religious beliefs as a political wedge issue. And to have it placed on the Capitol lawn to do such, we felt violated the Constitution, and seven members of the Supreme Court agreed with us. It's no surprise to watch politicians play politics with religion and try to use religion to divide people against themselves for their own political gain. Frankly, that was what the founders of our nation, of our republic, and of our state recognized whenever they said we have to create a separation of church and state to ensure both the long-term viability of religion and the long-term viability of the state, because if the two are intermixed with one another, both get polluted. And that's what we've seen to try to move away from. You know, the OCPA, they said that, you know, this is just like any, Michael Carnuccio, the director there, said this is just like any political issue. And that's where he's wrong. You know, this isn't just like any other political issue. There are certain issues that our Constitution, both at the state level and the federal level, remove from the political vicissitudes of the day-to-day controversies and put them beyond the reach of the politicians, or at least their immediate reach. And, you know, the decision of how to believe or whether to believe at all is one of those decisions. The state shouldn't put something on the Capitol grounds that says how you should believe. That they're raising money off of it doesn't surprise me. Scott Pruitt, even before they moved it, had something up on his political Facebook page. And this is, you know, there may very well be a ballot campaign. Even if there's not, you know, the Scott Pruitt for governor campaign is going to rely heavily upon this. This monument.
Neva.
Well, I think that any issue that there are strong polarizing factions on both sides, we're going to see not only it politicized, but that's part of the process. That's part of what makes us the citizen democracy that we are. And I think the other part of it is it's not surprising. In fact, you could argue, even though much of it would go the other direction, when you have these issues, let's take, for instance, whether it's this issue or we take on a national spectrum, we take Planned Parenthood versus National Right to Life. I mean, these groups use the vehicle of the issue, yes, to fundraise, to make budget, to be able to expand and extend their message out. So it's not surprising. I think that with respect to the Ten Commandments issue, we are going to see it go forward. I think it's very clear that Oklahomans will have it on the ballot next year and be able to vote on it. And during that process, there will be many, many people jump into the fray and use it not only to fundraise to get their message out, but to, just to expand the argument above and beyond where it is right now.
Is there not concern that when you use religion, when you use a religious text like the Ten Commandments for political gain, it waters down not only politics, but religion itself?
If you dismiss the notion that there is a historic context to the Ten Commandments as well as the religious context, and I think that's where, I mean, those who are opposed to it, period, want to just drop that wall and say that absolutely there should not be that argument, that debate, and I would suggest that that there are legitimate debating points on both sides, and they need to be heard.
When we elect individuals, though, we elect them to represent everyone, regardless of their faith or whether they have no faith at all. And when we politicize matters of faith, ultimately some groups end up being marginalized. And if people are elected on a platform that says, you elected me because of my faith, you elected me because of how I believe, then individuals that don't believe that particular way had better watch out. They're going to be marginalized.
But if an overwhelming number of people voted and said that these are the type of representatives that we want in office because they believe the way we do, or put it on the ballot and we are going to say, yes, we do want a monument on state property, and consequently we'll make those changes in the Constitution to allow for that, or at least set the stage to where any other future legal recourse has to go at the federal level and takes it away from the state appeals. I think that's where it's at, and I think that's a healthy process. And I think we have to remember on the fundraising side, I mean, people get bent out of shape when people talk about money and politics, and somehow that's all sinister and there's nothing legitimate to it. But when people have an opportunity to put their money behind issues they believe in, whether another person is on the opposite side of that, that is a healthy part of this process, and I would do anything to see that stay that way, as opposed to some who want to just on the extreme and say, let's just shut this down and let's not allow this to happen at all.
I just don't think it's extreme, though, to say that we shouldn't allow the majority by referendum to do things that marginalize individuals on the basis of faith. So the majority of Oklahoma's faith community, whether those are individuals that are Jewish, whether they're Hindu, whether they're Muslim, whether they're atheist, whomever that is, if we allow referendum by the majority, those minorities tend to be marginalized at the political processes as well.
The Oklahoma Republican Party selects Pam Pollard as its new chairman to replace Randy Brogdon, who stepped down after a controversial 5 months in office. There are now two women heading the state GOP. Neva, your thoughts on this pick?
Well, I think it is interesting. It is the only state in the country where we do have two women in the chair and vice chair positions of the party.
Technically three women if you consider Governor Vallen as the chair.
That's right. And so I think that from the Republican Party standpoint, I think many of the activists and the folks that were in the room on Sunday afternoon taking that vote, making a decision on who of the three candidates was best prepared to lead the party right now, I think they came out with two of the three now in office as the two heads of the Republican Party on the day-to-day operation. And I think that what we'll see is a refocus, and it'll be interesting to see whether once this is jump-started again, they will be successful in raising money again, which was really where the wheels came off with Randy Brogdon. I mean, you had a situation where so much controversy and so many people just basically checking out and saying this is not something financially we can support until some things change.
Ryan.
Well, and I don't know that they're going to step away from controversy with Pam Pollard. And I think if you go back sometime, I believe earlier this summer or late this spring of 2015, the Lost Ogle wrote a story about a Facebook post of Pam Pollard's that had nothing to do, the Facebook post that she ultimately took down regarding the Klan and the Democratic Party and welfare and how the Democratic Party used welfare to control minority communities. That is outrageous in and of itself. But she took that one down. She did not take down another post, and I'd like to know whether or not she still believes that we should do away with public schools, that little girls should stay at home with mom to learn how to keep house, and little boys should go to work with dad to learn how to make a living for the family, and that we could do away with textbooks and curriculums and just use the Bible to teach geography and science and math. I mean, those are really we talked about extreme earlier. To me, that's incredibly extreme. And if this is going to be the new voice of the Oklahoma GOP, then they should probably be rejoicing that party structures probably aren't as relevant as they used to be.
I don't think that's going to. I think that's taking all of that and kind of throwing it out there and trying to make it an extreme. I think one of the things that I would one of the things I'd like to point out about the process is that you had a situation where you had three candidates, and frankly, on the second ballot, basically what happened was you had. You had the other two candidates come together and say, "Let's elect the chairman by basically acclamation." And so it was a very strong show of unity, and I think that's what everyone has been looking at and seeing. Would that actually transpire? And I think that was one of the refreshing takeaways from the meeting, is that after a very vigorous and healthy campaign, that we do see some unity coming out of the party. I think the sidebar negative to all of that process was that again, we had peripheral individuals out there running extremely negative campaigns, kind of unilaterally to the party campaigns, trying to really assassinate the character of in particular Estela Hernandez, which was uncalled for. Whoever was responsible for it, and it's that kind of activity that's got to cease if any party is going to be successful in being able to get their bigger message out.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.